Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. We are going through the Bill of Rights and the amendments of the Constitution, and we're giving you context to most all of this stuff that we're going through at this point in time. And we're actually marrying up some of the background behind why this amendment and so forth. And so, obviously, anybody that understands history kind of understands, you know, the quartering and the militia and those types of things. But I still believe it's important to have a good foundation and association to why these very specific nugatory clauses were placed into the Constitution. So at this point in time, let's be clear. This show was also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. And this is the academic home of what we need to do, why we're doing it, and how this has been done. Anyway, I just want to move straight into the content because I want to cover more ground and less fluff, if you want to call it that, the obligatories and what have you. So we left off with the Fifth Amendment. And most everybody understands that the Fifth Amendment is the, you know, right to not incriminate yourself. And so we were halfway through this talking about the people that do not have Fifth Amendment protection are those who are in the military and or the militia and so forth. And so going back through this, no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment of indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia, when in actual service in time of war or public danger, nor shall any person be subject to the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. So I want you to understand that very last part, because everybody understands forfeiture and seizure. This is a part of the Constitution that nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. And so, in other words, they have to give you a reasonable... Now, when they say private property, that means your car. Anything that they seize from you in the commission of a crime, that you have to be compensated for that. And anyway, and I know that there's been a lot of buildup between individual rights, criminal rights, or the accused rights and lawyers. And bottom line, the Fifth Amendment and the intent was to ensure that no person could be manipulated and or forced into testifying against themselves. And that's why that's been pretty well held, and that no person can be held in a trial over the, you know, be tried and found guilty or not guilty. Actually, if you're found not guilty, then be tried again. Now, it's one thing if the case has been thrown out because of some technicalities, then you go through the process again. But if you go through the full process of a trial and are found not guilty, and then they try to try you again, that's called double jeopardy. So the Fifth Amendment, most people, you know, have heard and have seen movies, I Plead the Fifth, you know, in front of Congress and all of that. But this was something to protect a person's individual rights that they did not have to testify against themselves. The Sixth Amendment. Now, this is where we actually find, if I'm remembering correctly, this is where we find common law. Actually, it's in the Seventh, by trial by jury. So the Sixth Amendment, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law. Now, you got to understand that this is only, that these Fifth and Sixth and Seventh Amendments are only pertaining to the federal government. In all prosecutions, the accused shall have the right to a speedy trial and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation. So in other words, you have a right to know what charges you're facing, and you have a right to confront the witnesses against you, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process of obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. So this is where the right to a public, you know, counsel, this is the right to actually force or compel people to, you know, bear testimony in your favor and actually to challenge and confront the witnesses that are accusing you. And so this gets into the trial portions, but this only pertains to the federal government when prosecuting you for a crime. And what crimes does the federal government have cognizance over per the Constitution? Well, this would be either, what do they call that? Counterfeiting and or treason and or high crimes and misdemeanors committed on the high seas and or crimes committed against the laws of nations. So in other words, unless you've committed one of those crimes, you don't have to worry about the federal government coming after you because those are the only crimes that they have constitutional authority over. So in other words, drug crimes, kidnapping crimes, and all of these crimes that seem like really good things that, you know, we want to have as crimes, the federal government has no jurisdiction over those. Those are only state-prosecuted crimes, or only supposed to be state-prosecuted crimes, because the federal government has never been delegated the ability to actually charge and have cognizance and be able to determine punishment and all of that over any other crime other than those that are enumerated in the Constitution. And Thomas Jefferson, in the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798, clearly identified the only crimes that Congress or the federal government had authority over. So the Seventh Amendment, and this is the one that's important, because this is where they actually established the anchor for common law. In suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20. So in other words, they're only stipulating very specific things, but they've established the fact that all rights of common law, you have these rights of trial by jury. So in other words, in suits of common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved. In other words, if it's for a certain amount. And that's kind of changed by interpretation because the value of $20 is actually changed. I think it's what they consider petty crime and or a felony, a misdemeanor and felony. And so the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. So it establishes these, the common law actually dictates the rules of how things are to be tried or even reexamined. So if you've committed a murder and you want to appeal your conviction, the states have the right to establish by common law a process of how you are to be reexamined after you've been convicted of murder or what have you. And I think it's great that we've actually been able to inject and have the appeal process. But I don't want to go down this rat hole. I will just say that we have to have a better mechanism in ensuring that once somebody's been convicted, then I believe the defense needs to be able to prove a reasonable, and so you have to understand, in a trial, a person cannot be compelled to take a lie detector test or anything like that. But if they've been found guilty, they can actually and probably should have to take a voice stress analyzer, lie detector, brain mapping. We have all different technologies, and every single one should be utilized so that a defendant, you know, can say, hey, look, I'm really innocent here, and I want to use these things to help, you know, compel the state into re-examining. And if a person passes the litany of different tests that you're not lying, that you really didn't, you know, cause this harm, you didn't commit this crime, then they should be going out of their way to help do an appeals process to help delineate, you know, exactly what happened and whether you're really guilty or not, even though the prior to the trial process, you have these protections. I think to re-engage, and again, I think that we need to start considering using the technologies available as a criteria to, you know, to help determine whether the trial was, and I know there are probably criminal law or criminal lawyers are listening, oh, no, this is terrible. But, you know, we as a civil society, we do make mistakes, and it's far better to let a guilty man go free than an innocent man go to jail. But when the process is done, I think, and we'll have to pause right here because we're at a break here, so we'll be right back, and I'll give you the rest of the story here.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com.
Folks, I know everything's going haywire and sideways, or however you want to put it. And I want to let you know that we're already dug in on doing today's content regarding the amendments, but we will be coming guns a-blazing tomorrow to basically call for Trump to remove Governor Whitmer, as well as all of these governors who have violated their oath of office. And as a matter of fact, he can't let them grandstand and try to take shots at him publicly and politically. He needs to step in, and he needs to actually support the Constitution, because these governors, these politicians, are violating their oath of office, and we need to hold them accountable. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through a lot of real information that will actually address both the vice president as well as the rest of the propaganda that is going out there. Like I said, we're coming guns a-blazing.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
Okay, so I believe that the appeals process needs to be re-examined, because I do believe that when a trial goes forward and it comes to closure, you've got a guilty, then I believe that maybe the jury, the judge, all the different parties have to really kind of come to the table and say, you know, because the defense is always going to say, we want to appeal this, especially if they have unlimited money. Now, you have to understand that the free process is a very slow process, and it is not as just as a person that has money. Our system is not supposed to be based, our justice system is not supposed to favor those with money and those without money. And so it doesn't matter if necessarily the rich defense says we want to appeal, and they're just going to keep on appealing and appealing so that their client can somehow find a way to get out of serving time and or what have you. So the point I'm trying to make is that I believe that we really need to look at to protect, to ensure that justice is served, because it's nice to have mercy, but when you give the ability to an individual to be merciful, then that is based on the paradigm of the individual. And the reason I say we have to be very careful is because I do understand those who are on the left, because as we've looked at the mercy that has been administered by the leftist presidents by giving what do they call that? Pardon. And they pardon these absolute criminals, these terrible people. And it is done for whatever purpose, because this person has money and can give them a lot of money. So in other words, when in the hands of an individual, does that person really deserve that power? Now, the Constitution grants the president to be able to do this. I think we have, over the course of the history of this nation, that we've seen how the pardon powers by the president, because of ideological bent and because of other purposes, because they're just immoral, like Bill Clinton, where, you know, he actually pardoned some pretty heinous people, and even Obama. And not the conservatives like Bush's and so forth have been great. The bottom line is it's ideological. And so I don't necessarily like that pardoning. Unfortunately, you know, if we take it away, then it makes it impossible for mercy to be administered. But there's a lot to be said for electing a good moral person, because an immoral person will actually allow criminals to be freed so that they can stand to gain. So to me, this is kind of like the shame America must bear when we actually allow an immoral person to take that office with that ultimate power. Back to the system, though. I believe that we can put checks and balances within this process for both the prosecution, as well as the judge, as well as the defendants and other people, to actually go through and feel it, because they can identify instantly whether there has been a problem in process, procedure, or what have you, or if other facts come to bear, you know, innocence or what have you. If those types of things actually, you know, befall, instead of just going through the appeal process, that's one thing, then that person should be given a free path to a appeal. But if it is just a matter of stalling time, then because I want you to understand, the person, whether they be rich or not, and they're trying to buy their way out of their crime, if we have a hard requirement that says, hey, you know, based on all processes, all evidence, and everything else, the jury has unanimously convicted you of guilty. Putting aside, even you can even denote the possibility of racism and those types of things to say, because racism might be the issue, then we're not going to create this ultimate test. But I do believe we do need to actually make it so that anybody that has had their process of trial and they've been found guilty, before they can actually push the button to say, I automatically want to spend my money to get a, you know, an appeal, I believe that they need to go through some battery of tests to prove that they actually, you know, shed some evidence that there is a possibility of innocence. before we actually allow that. Because if it's a slam dunk case, let's say Bill Gates, or George Soros, here's somebody that we're trying for the crimes against humanity and the things that they have done in, supporting the killing of people, the incarcerations of people, the releasing of unjust people and so forth. We want to make sure that there are some checks and balances throughout the process, but we also want to make sure that just because the person has money doesn't mean he can bog down the court system because they have money. And so if we've convicted George Soros of a crime that, is going to put him away for life because of the treason and the things that he's been doing in waging war against the United States and the American people, then for him to be able to get to an appeal process, he would have to go through a battery of these tests that he would have to prove via lie detector, brain scan, voice stress analyzer, these other lie detection types of modes that we have to determine if this guy can actually pass all these tests. If Soros can actually pass these tests, then okay, we will allow him to, bog down the system with another appeal. But we have to stop just giving people because they have a right to have their facts, re-examined. And I know that it's a Seventh Amendment right. And again, no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of common law. So I think we have the ability, because the Constitution clearly says that we don't have to re-examine cases other than these rules of common law. And again, I still embrace this concept that it's far better for a guilty man to go free than an innocent man to go, go to jail and or be deprived of their liberty, their life, and so forth. Anyway, let's move on to the Eighth Amendment, excessive bail and cruel punishment. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed. Folks, I have a real problem with this, because what's excessive? It all depends on the individual, their affluence, their wealth, and everything else. And I do not believe that a carpenter who only makes, let's say, $80,000 a year, and he has a DUI, I do not believe his bail should be, it should be proportionate to their financial position. In other words, let's have let's just say Ben Roethlisberger, who makes millions of dollars, who had a DUI, and we had this carpenter who had a DUI. Same circumstances, but they have the same amount of bail. And that, to me, is a travesty, because it is an excessive amount of bail on the carpenter in comparison to Ben Roethlisberger. And depending on the crime, the bail should be apropos for the effect. So in other words, if we have a bail of, the standing bail of $20,000, $10,000 for the average person, well, that would be based on the average income. I honestly think we need to remove the averages and the means out of this bail process and actually go by the individual. How much money do they make a year, and or how much money do they have at their disposal? Because if they have millions of dollars in the bank, then they should be hit with a bail that is proportionate as it would be affected to the common man. Doesn't that make sense? I mean, if we're supposed to have a fair system, then the bail should be equal to the, for a person that only has a little compared to a person that has a lot. And so I'm not trying to be Robin Hood here. I am just trying to make the playing field going into the penal system, going into court, a level playing field. You have to have the level or an even or an equal amount of pain going in. So, these football stars, these elitists that can commit crimes and they just throw their checks around and they never see the jails. They never spend a day in jail. Well, I say that if you actually have a bail that actually goes after, all of their money, so that, shoot, now what am I going to do? I can't make my house payments. So in other words, if you want to get out of jail and you want to be free, you have to pay bail until you go through your process, and then you pay your particular fine. I honestly believe that the bail and imposed fine should be equal. In other words, if you're willing to make a mistake that's going to commit the type of crime, and I'll just use DUI because we really have ramped up the punishment on DUI for the common person, but for the elitist, it's nothing. It is literally nothing to them. And so if we're supposed to have a fair judiciary process and a fair penal system, then we absolutely need to ensure that we have a full level playing field, both at the bail level, the fines and punishments and everything else. And it should no longer be a set dollar. It should be based on the percentage of what a person can make. What about a homeless person or a person that just got laid off? Anyway, we'll be right back. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL. Or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing. Folks, I know everything's going haywire and sideways, or however you want to put it. And I want to let you know that we're already dug in on doing today's content regarding the amendments, but we will be coming guns a-blazing tomorrow to basically call for Trump to remove Governor Whitmer, as well as all of these governors who have violated their oath of office. And as a matter of fact, he can't let them grandstand and try to take shots at him publicly and politically. He needs to step in, and he needs to actually support the Constitution, because these governors, these politicians, are violating their oath of office, and we need to hold them accountable. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through a lot of real information that will actually address both the vice president as well as the rest of the propaganda that is going out there. Like I said, we're coming guns a-blazing.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Okay, so we just covered the Eighth Amendment. And bottom line, we didn't really go into nor cruel or unusual punishment inflicted. Well, you got to understand, the firing squad, hanging. If you look at some of the things that were considered at that time standard, stockades and those types of things, I just believe that what they were talking about was really not to be cruel in torturing a person. And, putting somebody to death is one thing, but, slowly doing it. And as a matter of fact, I'll give you a good example. I believe it was Islam and the punishment of certain crimes, where what they would do, and I forget the name of it, but what they would do is they would basically press a human between two like boards, plates or what have you, to basically press them, and you'd be naked, and then they would just allow yourself to basically die from being consumed by bugs and those types. And we're talking about very cruel and foul torture. So one of the things that the framers, or in writing the Constitution, they did not want that type of punishment to be inflicted. If it's a capital crime, there are very specific things: to be hanged, to be shot, and now we have electricity and so forth. And so injection, they wanted to be as humanly possible in taking the life, and not to become a cruel society in inflicting that type of anguish, pain, and suffering. Anyway, one of the things that they did, though, to be clear, they did have debtor's prison. If you couldn't pay your debt, you went to prison. You didn't just get a financial withholding or a court order to basically, you know, so they can get their pound of flesh out of you. When you were convicted of a, you know, financial crime, of a debtor's crime, you went to prison, and that was it. Then that, now let me ask you this: would you rather go to prison for not being able to pay your house and, you know, spend 5 years in prison and then be free of that punishment hanging over your head? How many people do we know that have been hit with debtor types of convictions, and, you know, they literally locks them into not being able to ever buy a house or anything else, because that punishment lingers over their head for the rest of their life. It's almost like student debt. You cannot get rid of it. You can't go and serve your time and say, I made my mistake, but, you know, but to have to be, to me, that is almost borders that unusual and or cruel punishment, to have somebody have to suffer the rest of their lifetime for that, the failing to pay that debt. And so anyway, let's move on. That was the Eighth Amendment. The Ninth Amendment is really interesting, because this is right here where they basically, it's the rule of construction of the Constitution. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. In other words, your right, the federal government's right to lay taxes, and or their right to call you into service or what have you, does not mean that they can take away other rights because of that. So the Ninth Amendment is a protection of the individual people, to say just because the Constitution powered them doesn't mean that they can take away your right of, and I'll give you an example. The draft and serving in the military was clearly a constitutional thing. I mean, everybody is obligated to serve and can be called into service. It's the same thing with the militia. And so the draft was one of those things that allowed the state and the federal government to be able to call you into service. Now, there were certain things that were construed as rights, like your right of religious expression. And so people that were going out on missions and or serving in a religious capacity, they did not disparage or deny those people who were exercising that right to have to go into compulsion. Now, they also started extending that, because somewhere in the process, the people who had money said, hey, but what if our child is going to school and they're being educated? Shouldn't we be able to allow them to continue this education, so that they, you know, can be spared for having to go into the service? And actually what it also did was it kept them from going into the service as a enlisted. No son of mine is going to be going in, because you have to have a college degree to be an officer. I'm just telling you that the whole construction and the rule of construction in protecting rights that can't be taken away because of an enumerated power, they started making little, I'll just say, these little advantages for those of affluence. And it is contrary to the paradigm of what the framers tried to create. They didn't try to create a land of opportunity as well as a land that, you know, gives an advantage to those who have money and or affluence of some kind, whether that be just because, you know, you're the descendant of, you know, John Adams, or you're the descendant of George Washington. Not that there was there's many of those at all, but anyway, the point is that the rule of construction basically protected all your other rights so that they couldn't be denied you from an enumerated power of the Constitution. So that was a big protection that the framers wanted to ensure, and Madison made sure it got in there. The 10th Amendment, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states. So the Constitution denies the states certain things. We went through that in Article 1, Section 10. So anything that the states can't do, like passing ex post facto laws, but if there is something that's not delegated nor listed in Section 10 of Article 1, then the states have reserved that right, and or the people have reserved that right, and that the government, the federal government, does not have that power. So in other words, the power of energy, is that anywhere in the Constitution that the federal government shall be able to regulate and control and dictate energy policies and so forth? Nope, and it's not under the Commerce Clause, because back in those days they had energy. They had, you know, wax candles. They had, help me out here. They had firewood. They had coal. They had different fuels and so forth. And people understand that fuel was necessary for productivity, for energy was necessary to be productive, whether that be food or what have you. And the federal government had no, because they were eating back then. They were keeping their houses warm. They were using energy to maintain productivity. Federal government had no delegated power over energy whatsoever, but today they have it. And clearly, the powers not delegated to the United States or to the federal government by the Constitution, then those rights and the power to regulate those things was left to the states or the people themselves. In other words, if the states don't have it in their Constitution, then those things are left to the people. So, as you understand, we've kind of wrapped up the 10 amendments. And just to be clear on the 10th Amendment as well, just because the states may have a constitution that delegates them, the real question that a person needs to find and has to determine, does the state have general powers? Because if you, the people, have delegated general powers to your state, you have made a huge mistake. And understanding an enumerated constitution and a general constitution is something that everybody needs to understand, just as Mr. Iredell put it regarding powers of attorney, a general power of attorney and a specified or enumerated power of attorney. Anyway, here we go into the 11th Amendment. And this is interesting because right after the Bill of Rights, just a year or two later, in a case that we call, and I believe the case was Chisholm v. Georgia, so that was in 1793, that the Supreme Court overstepped its bounds and basically took sovereignty away from the states. And so in looking at the 11th Amendment, what does it say? The judicial power of the United States shall not be construed to extend to any suit in law or equity commenced or prosecuted against one of the United States by citizens of another state or by citizens or subjects of any foreign state. So in other words, after this decision of Chisholm v. Georgia, they created this amendment to keep the federal government from being able to overstep their bounds. The 11th Amendment was adopted to overrule that Supreme Court decision in that case, that the Supreme Court held that the states do not enjoy sovereign immunity from suits made by citizens of other states or foreigners. And so anyway, here was another process that they said, hey, you know, you can't take away our sovereignty. Anyway, we'll be right back after these two promos. Please stay tuned. We'll be into the 12th Amendment really quick. Folks, I know everything's going haywire and sideways, or however you want to put it. And I want to let you know that we're already dug in on doing today's content regarding the amendments, but we will be coming guns a-blazing tomorrow to basically call for Trump to remove Governor Whitmer, as well as all of these governors who have violated their oath of office. And as a matter of fact, he can't let them grandstand and try to take shots at him publicly and politically. He needs to step in and he needs to actually support the Constitution, because these governors, these politicians, are violating their oath of office, and we need to hold them accountable. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through a lot of real information that will actually address both the vice president as well as the rest of the propaganda that is going out there. Like I said, we're coming guns a-blazing.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, so right after the Constitution was ratified and after the Bill of Rights was ratified, the federal court overstepped its bounds in this case, Chisholm v. Georgia. And so the states were pretty upset with the fact that the federal government was able to inject itself into suits made by citizens of other states in a federal court. So in other words, citizens of other states were dragging states in, you know, a state that they weren't a resident of, into a federal court. And so the 11th Amendment said, you can't do that. And so the states, in other words, took a stand for their sovereignty and created the 11th Amendment. Now, what ended up happening, because right out the gate, the court system already started overreaching its bounds with the Constitution, and so the states quickly stepped up and said, nope, we're drawing the line, we're not allowing you to do this, and so they wrote the 11th Amendment. But it didn't take long for the Supreme Court to actually start changing and applying to all federal suits against states brought by private parties. So in other words, it may not be a citizen, but it may be a private party or a company or what have you. And so the courts have been notorious for trying to expand their powers. And even though the 11th Amendment drew another line in the sand, the Supreme Court and the court system itself has been able to aggrandize and kind of blur that line, allowing the courts and I'll just use the term activist, because that's usually the people that are trying to use the courts to move the law one way or another. But here's the biggest thing you have to understand. Nowhere in the Constitution did it grant to the federal government the court's ability to make something constitutional. In other words, amend the Constitution to say homosexual marriage is now a right. No. As a matter of fact, the only way that the federal government can obtain the jurisdiction over marriage period, not just homosexual marriage period, is for the states to amend and delegate that authority over marriage. And so that's what you have to understand. The real enemy is the court system. The real enemy is Congress and or the federal government. And we have to look at this adversarial role between these three branches of the general government and the different states, and how the general government can work with a couple of states to get them to help further an agenda. And so it just goes to show that the 11th Amendment proves that right out the gate, there were already shenanigans being done, and that the states followed the constitutional process and demanded that Congress give them amendment to reel the court in. Okay? So moving on, now we have the 12th Amendment. And as we've already gone through this, I just want to just recap the manner of choosing the president. And what we have here with the 11th, actually the Bill of Rights, the 11th Amendment, and the 12th Amendment, we clearly have precedents that the only way to delegate a power or to redefine something that is within the enumerated powers or processes and or configuration of the federal government is through an amendment. That's the only way. And so I just want you to understand clearly how we, you know, have these hardcore limitations placed upon the general government. One of the things that I didn't have that we were actually looking at the 13th Amendment because that's what's coming up next, and say, and so what I want to do is I want to actually have I want to give you the 13th Amendment that has been asserted as passed. This is a contested article, and or the 13th Amendment that was actually supposedly ratified in 1819. And this is the 13th Amendment that is missing in the Constitution. If any citizen of the United States shall accept, claim, receive, or retain any title of nobility or honor, or shall, without the consent of Congress, accept and retain any present, pension, office, or emolument of any kind whatever from any emperor, king, prince, or foreign power, such person shall cease to be a citizen of the United States and shall be incapable of holding any office or trust or of profit or of trust or profit under them or either of them. What this was, and this was, I believe, a line between the ability for the Bar Association and that the Club of Lawyers to keep them from being able to ever hold office. And so there's a lot behind that, but because that is a, you know, an amendment in question. Now, I get into these weeds with lots of different people over the 13th Amendment, or the real 13th Amendment, which is what I just read. And these people are, you know, they go, oh, this is such a problem that we have this. Okay. Nowhere in that amendment does it really make that big of a difference. Okay, so what do we do if we have lawyers? This was maybe a line that says lawyers can't become public servants. Anybody that's a part of the Bar Association, because I believe the Bar Association was established by the British Crown. And so, right, wrong, or indifferent, and I don't want to get into the history of all of it. The point in fact is this. Is that just because we have a lawyer, just because we have a Mohammedan, just because we have an individual who has nefarious intent, doesn't mean that they can actually bypass the Constitution and their oath of office. In other words, they can't do things legally. They may get away with doing things illegally, but the day we decide to come after them, they are subject to the full wrath of the law. And we can unleash that and prosecute them fully for everything that they've done. To be clear, We have these measures. The problem is that we don't hold these people accountable. That's what's got to change. And Section 3 of the 14th Amendment was a huge leap in empowering the people as well as all facets of government to being able to hold everybody accountable to their oaths of office. Anyway, moving beyond and going into the 12th Amendment, as you know, if you read the 12th Amendment, it clearly did not change to allow parties to hold hostage so that the parties hold hostage of the outcome of the election. Nor does it give the state legislatures the ability to determine the outcome. In other words, they have the ability to provide for the choosing of electors, but not to determine who those electors are. We, the people, choose who will represent us in a representative government, and every state that has a winner-take-all law on the representatives of our electors in choosing the president is violating the Constitution, because nowhere in this, in Article 2 and in the 12th Amendment and in the 20th Amendment were the state legislators granted the ability to determine who would be the representatives. No, that was always left to us people. They could only determine the process of how we elected them. And it was never, nowhere in here does it mention that the party can be done or anything like that. There is no connecting the dots to the system that we have today to the constitutional process. And so what we're looking at, and the reason we have been in literally the twos and fros of such volatility in our presidential elections, is because we're not following the Constitution. If we force them to amend the Constitution as they always have, then I'm just telling you, it would be dragged through the states in debate, and the states would never allow it, and we would still be following the process that we're supposed to be following. So I'm not going to reread the whole thing. The 13th Amendment that we actually have, that's right, we already kind of covered the supposed 13th Amendment. Sorry for revisiting the 12th. The 13th Amendment that we actually have was passed by Congress in January 31, 1865. You know what? Let me give you the history before this. In 1861, now this was just after, or I believe in the process of Lincoln coming to power because he was just elected, I believe Lincoln championed, because the southern states were already rattling their sabers that they were going to leave the Union and they were going to secede. And Lincoln didn't want that to happen. Now, nowhere in this process did Lincoln actually say, hey, you can't constitutionally secede from the Union. That was a knee-jerk reaction, and it was not founded on anything within the Constitution or contractual law. But anyway, prior to Lincoln becoming a president, there was actually a 13th Amendment proposed, and it said that, and this was basically it, and I'm going to read it real quick. No amendment shall be made to the Constitution which will authorize or give Congress the power to abolish or interfere within any state the domestic institutions thereof, including that of persons, health, or labor service by the law. So anyway, I will dive into this when we get back. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I know everything's going haywire and sideways, or however you want to put it. And I want to let you know that we're already dug in on doing today's content regarding the amendments, but we will be coming guns a-blazing tomorrow to basically call for Trump to remove Governor Whitmer, as well as all of these governors who have violated their oath of office. And as a matter of fact, he can't let them grandstand and try to take shots at him publicly and politically. He needs to step in and he needs to actually support the Constitution, because these governors, these politicians are violating their oath of office, and we need to hold them accountable. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through a lot of real information that will actually address both the vice president as well as the rest of the propaganda that is going out there. Like I said, we're coming guns a-blazing.